Yeah, really excited to be here. I'm going to be talking today about reliability at Facebook, and in particular, one big incident we had recently and sort of the things that we learned from it. So reliability is obviously something that's really important to us at Facebook, and it's also something that's been one of the biggest challenges as we scale the site. So as I'm sure you all know, we're growing pretty fast, and we have been for a long time. And this leads to a lot of technical challenges. These are some of the big numbers we deal with every day. A couple of my favorites are we have a cache with 2 trillion objects in it, and we access it several hundred million times per second. So there's obviously a lot of things that are hard about getting this system to work. Many of the hardest things really do revolve around reliability. Because when you're building a distributed system, there's sort of the first order problems of, I've got a bunch of stuff that needs to be done, and how do I spread that across a lot of machines to get it done? And that's not necessarily easy, but it's usually fairly straightforward and sort of can understand how well you're doing at it. A lot of the more interesting problems are because once you have a lot of machines doing something, you have a lot of machines failing. You have a lot of things going wrong. And handling that gracefully really ends up being sort of the hard part of running big distributed systems. So over the years at Facebook, as we've been doing this, we've developed a number of principles about how we think about this. And we think they've served us pretty well. I've worked at Facebook for 4.5 years. And in that time, the longest we've ever been down is 2.5 hours. And so I'm going to talk today about that particular incident. And then I'm going to hand it off to Sanjeev, who is going to talk sort of more generally about some of the principles and some of the ways we think about things. We're also going to leave a lot of time at the end for questions. We also have Adam and Pedro here who are going to help us out with questions. So I guess before I get into the story of a site outage, I want to talk a little bit about sort of the context in which it happened. So if you look at this graph of our growth, one of the things you'll notice is there's nowhere where it's flat. There's nowhere along here where we got to say, you know, wow, we got through that one. Let's catch our breath and sit back for a minute and think about what we might do next time. Every week, we have our biggest day ever. And so what that means is that we are always in uncharted territory. Obviously, we know where that graph is headed. We've got a pretty good idea, but it's always something new and always a surprise. And so in the most general sense, the thing we need to be able to do to deal with scaling is to be able to have an operations and engineering team that are able to deal with things as they come up and deal with the unexpected. So one of our deepest values is that we are able to move fast. This is also the philosophy of our product teams, because our product teams are similarly often in uncharted territory where they're not just trying to build something, they're trying to build the thing that people are going to use and people are going to like, and it's not clear what that is because we're not building something a lot of people have done before. And we found the best way to do that is to try a lot of things and see what works, which is a great strategy for making good products, but it also means that in terms of operations and infrastructure, the site is always changing. We push code, usually either new code or configuration changes multiple times per day, and we do a full release of everything on the site once a week. So what that means in terms of of running the site is that we have this massive system running under massive load, getting bigger all the time, and it's sort of always at an unprecedented level of scale, and the code is changing all the time. And so our general strategy is to make frequent small changes. The product people like doing this because it means they're never sitting around waiting for the big release to go out or arguing with somebody about which release they're going to be in. I like it because when you have a problem in production, you usually spend the bulk of the time resolving it, figuring out what went wrong. And if you've only changed one thing, it's a lot easier to figure out what went wrong. If you get a large number of changes batched up, that's when you get this terrible situation where you have no idea what's happening. It could be anything. So even when we do really big changes, we'll try to break them up and make them look like a series of small changes. So for instance, if we're going to take a big back end and replace it with another one, we'll actually bring the new one up completely in parallel. to throw whatever tests we can at it, and then we'll slowly start ramping traffic over from the old one to the new one. And then, you know, invariably something breaks, we dial it back, we figure out what went wrong, we start dialing it up again, and sort of repeat until the new one actually works. And then once we're comfortable with how the new one's working, we can turn off the old one. The other thing I wanted to talk about very briefly is the architecture of the site. So at the core of it, it is very typical Web 2.0 architecture. We have, so a request comes in for a web page. It gets load balanced to a web server. That's just a commodity server running PHP. It runs a PHP program that puts together the page. Every page is dynamic because it depends on who is the viewer, what are they allowed to see. It depends on the particular context. The page is assembled out of usually hundreds or even thousands of pieces of information that are stored on Memcache servers. And so Memcache, if you're not familiar with it, is just sort of the simplest thing that you can imagine for a server. You can push data in, it holds it in memory, and then you can pull it back out. It's very, very fast. And so this is, the Memcache layer is where a lot of our scaling problems show up, because this is a layer where we're hitting hundreds of millions of requests a second. It hits the network very hard. So a lot of our scaling problems are around being able to get lots of throughput out of Memcache and, more importantly, get lots of throughput out of the network. Then the persistent copy of the data is stored in MySQL databases. And now each of these tiers is thousands of machines all spread horizontally. We have a database cluster on one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, and then around each of them we have multiple what we call front-end clusters, which are web servers and Memcache servers. So the thing that's important about Memcache and the database, at least for this story, is that Memcache is a look-aside cache. It's controlled by the client. So Memcache and MySQL have no knowledge of each other, and all the orchestration around keeping the data in the two of them consistent is handled by the client. And so when we do a read, the client will ask Memcache for the value, and if it gets it, then great, you're done. If it doesn't, it will ask for it from the database and then set it into Memcache. When we do a write, we will update the database, and then we will delete the value in the cache. And then the idea is the next client along will go to the cache, see that there's nothing there, and it will go to the database and set the value back in Memcache. So to get back to the story, I started on Thursday morning at 11 o'clock. We pushed two big changes to the site. Already reviling the first rule I mentioned, which we weren't just changing one thing at the time. We had two changes. One of them was a big risky change. We were pushing a new version of our Memcache proxy code, which basically pushes updates to the cache around to different data centers. This is risky because if you get it wrong, you can corrupt caches, you can screw up the main data store. And it's also just tricky code to get right because it carries a lot of volume. The other change was completely the opposite. It is about as mundane a change as you can imagine. We were pushing out a new package of JavaScript files. And what this thing is, so with JavaScript, you have lots of little files that people write code in and that needs to get down to a browser. And it turns out that if you you usually want to concatenate these together into larger files that are the optimal size for the browser to get. And so because our code changes every week, we run a script every week that comes up with a new optimal packet. And this runs on a cron job. It's run on a cron job for years and never been a problem. And once we get the new package, we push it into production for 1% of the users. The idea is that we're only risking 1% of users. And then we can measure what's going on. We can look at, is this package actually more efficient? Is there, are we getting higher error rates on anything? And just sort of check all the things that this looks good, and then we can slowly roll it out to everyone. So we push both these changes, and immediately egress drops, and alarms start going off, and the site's down. So the first thing we did was spend a lot of time trying to figure out how this big risky change had caused this to happen. The first thing that came flooding through the logs was something about an inconsistent piece of data, and we ran around trying to figure out how we'd broken the site with our big change to the Memcache proxy. Of course, it turned out that that change was perfectly fine, and it was the little mundane change that had actually caused all the problems. So what we found is that as we started looking at what was broken inside the site, other than egress being down, there was one cluster of databases that was getting badly overloaded. Basically, every single web server had a connection into this small cluster. It was maybe 4 or 6 machines. And it turned out that one of the things that this database, one of the pieces of data that this database held was the configuration information for the JavaScript packages. And so what had happened is we had a bug that had allowed, when we updated the configuration, it had left it in an inconsistent state. And then another piece of software that was supposed to correct these kind of errors had not worked as intended and had actually made things worse. It sort of kicked off a chain reaction that led to this database being pounded with traffic. So I'm going to talk about each of those in sort of both the bug and then, more importantly, the thing that went out of control afterwards. So the first bug, I would like to say, is some very subtle, tricky case of distributed systems, but it's not. It was just a bug. There were, when you set up the package definition, it was actually 2 records in the database, and it turned out there was a code path that would allow one of these to be set and not the other, so the whole thing was in an inconsistent state. This bug had been there for a long time, but for whatever reason, we happened to hit the race condition that caused this one to fail this day. And the reason why it didn't affect just 1% of users was that it wasn't actually the package that was going out to 1% of users that was inconsistent. It was the thing that decided which 1% of users it should go to. And this is a pattern we actually see pretty often. You know, you try to break everything into lots of nice separate pieces so that you can, you know, things are isolated. And when we pushed this change, we really thought we were isolating it to 1% of users. But there's almost always at least one layer where you decide, you know, how to split things up into parts. And that one very often is a fragile part of the system. It often is a single point of failure that's very hard to get around. So even though, you know, we had multiple machines that held this, but when this part of the system wasn't behaving correctly, it sort of by definition had to affect everything. It's also really easy to look back at this and say, okay, well, we sort of backed out everything that happened, and it started with this bug where we got an inconsistent database record. And it's easy to say, okay, well, how do we not do this again? We just don't have these bugs. You know, that was a mistake. You know, we got to be more careful about this. This thing's really important. But I actually don't really agree with that. At the end of the day, you know, mistakes happen. These are people who build these systems, and people make mistakes, even the very best people. And the only way to really not make mistakes is to not do anything, which is not a good way to live life. And even if this hadn't been a mistake, the same story could follow if it were, you know, this was a bug in the kernel, or this was a, you know, a disk corruption. There's any number of things that would have led the client to get a bad value for this. So instead of focusing on how to not make that mistake again, what we want to focus on is how to make this mistake not be catastrophic. And so the second half of this talk is a very good example of what not to do to make a system robust. We had written something that we thought was going to help in this kind of situation, but it actually made it a lot worse. And so I'm going to walk through that in a lot of detail. So we have a... We had a system whose purpose was to fix issues if we got inconsistent data in this configuration system, because it is important that this be consistent. It's unfortunately a little bit naive. What it did is it said, okay, if I've got a bad value in Memcache, the client's going to read that. It's going to see, okay, this value, you know, it's going to run some heuristic to see, is that thing empty? Is it inconsistent? Is it garbage? Whatever. If it's something that we can detect that this isn't good, it will delete it. The idea being that the next guy who comes along is going to see that's empty, they'll query the good value from the database and put it back in Memcache. And this works really well if you have transient failures in Memcache. Basically, whenever the cache gets into a weird state, somebody comes along and they clean it up, we go on our way, things look really good. Unfortunately, on this day, the bad value wasn't in Memcache, it was in the database. And as soon as it was set in the database, then it got set in Memcache. And the first client comes along and says, aha, that's a bad value. I'm going to delete it. The next client comes along, queries in the database, and puts the bad value back. And the problem is, we don't have just two clients like this picture. We've got thousands and thousands of clients. And every one of them, each time they come in, is either deleting the cache, or they're seeing that the cache is empty, and they're pounding the database. So all of a sudden, we had tens of thousands of web servers all pounding these small handful of databases that held this configuration information. So the first step of the fix is, well, we'll just clean up that data. We'll go in and clear it out. Well, it turned out there was actually another problem, which was probably the worst one of all, which was that if a client asked the database for a value and that query failed, it would put something in memcache that that was later interpreted as invalid. So as long as any client was failing a database connection, then it was putting something in the cache that caused an error and caused future database connections. So we essentially had gone into a feedback loop where as long as the database was failing anything, it was causing things to happen that would cause people to increase the load on it, and that made it fail worse. So this whole thing was, there was basically no way to break the cycle on this. So what we actually had to do was shut the site down and basically stop all traffic coming in so that this would stop. Funny thing, it actually is a lot harder than we thought to stop the site. It's because we hadn't ever done it before. And like things you haven't done don't typically work the first time you try it. And in fact, it was not very clean to shut down the site and get it back up. We did a few other things. Once we realized what was happening, we did a whole bunch of contingency plans all at once. We just started making tons and tons of replicas of this database to brute force it. That was our worst case scenario fix. We hacked up a memcache configuration that would basically take updates for this particular key and just pipe them to dev null and ignore them. And then we went in the PHP code and just commented out this whole unfortunate feature that tried to fix things. And so we ended up, we got the site turned off, and finally the load to the database cleared, set it to a good value. We ended up pushing the code that just commented out this feature, and then very slowly added traffic back and ramped it up, and the site did come back to life. So what should we do differently to make the system work? We have a bunch of other, we have a couple other systems that do configuration, and they follow a different pattern, which has been far more reliable for us. And so this system that went down, we're currently moving to this kind of a system. And what it is you have, instead of playing this game with this look-aside cache with this that has to be coordinated by a client, you have a configuration server, and when it makes a change, it sends it out to the client. And one thing that's important about this is the client then can do the sanity check before it actually throws away its old value. So one of the problems in the previous system is that you clear the old value and then you set the new value, but the new value is bad. You're really kind of screwed. But if you can say, I'm going to check the new value coming in, and once I know it's good, then I'll drop the old one, then you're always running with something that at least sort of passes your sanity check. The other reason this is good is a little more subtle, which is that this is sort of inherently throttled to as fast as these configuration servers can go and update people. Because really, one of the root problems here is that you have an asymmetric situation where you have tens of thousands of web servers and a small handful of machines that hold the configuration. So no matter what software you write or what you do, if you enter a situation where the very large number of machines all turn on the small number of machines at once and do something coordinated, they're bound to kill them. And so sort of the design pattern is, if you have a large number of machines and a small number of machines that interact, you always want the small number to initiate things. Because even no matter how badly that small number of machine runs amok, you're never going to get, it's never going to kill the large number of machines. But the other way, you don't have to have much of an anomaly in 10,000 machines to generate enough traffic to topple 10 machines. And I think with that, I'm going to hand it off to Sanjeev to...
So before I get into some of the lessons we've learned over the years, let me talk about how Facebook is fundamentally different from a number of traditional sites out there. So at the heart of everything that we do at Facebook is the social graph. The social graph has information about people and how they're connected to other people and their interests and so on. And every aspect of the product on the site relies on querying the social graph to get information, to figure out what to show, what's most relevant, and so on. This actually makes a big impact on what, how the systems are built, what the requirements of the systems are, and so on. A simplified view of a traditional website for this example, let's pretend the site is an email site, would look like this. So if you're a small site, you have a few people with accounts, say Bob in this particular case, and you're trying to serve email for that person, what you do is you set up a set of machines that can store all the emails of for Bob and have a PHP code that knows how to access these storage servers and send and serve emails. A system like this is much easier to scale. So as you add more and more clients, what you do is you set up more and more of these clusters in parallel so that when you have six different clients coming in, they all go to different subsets. There is very little connectedness here, and so things tend to scale easily. So there are lots of other challenges on sites like this, but scaling is a little bit easier than what we face. Now, if we switch to what we have to do, mostly because of the social graph that's underlying all our systems, to serve any page, we need to access a lot of data based on the social graph. So let's say Beth came to her site and she wants to access data. What you need to do is you go to the social graph, find out all the friends that she has, all the pages she's interested in, find out all the latest posts on those sites, all the content on that site that was most recently posted, look at the permissions on each item because we allow permissions on every single item posted on the site to see if Beth is allowed to see that piece of content or not. So now we at this point, we would have a large list of potential content to show to the particular user. And now you have to figure out what's the most relevant piece of content to show to that particular user by figuring out who the closest friends are, which items have generated the most amount of interest, and so on. So essentially, there's a lot of steps involved and a lot of data you could potentially be seeing at any given point. Now, of course, for every single page, we don't go through all these steps because we do lots of smart things in the background to do this much more efficiently. But the bottom line here is that to generate a single page, you could be accessing tens or even hundreds of different machines to find the data to be shown to a particular user. So coming back to the point, the Facebook site is like fundamentally different from traditional sites. Not surprisingly, the connectedness of the data translates into connectedness in the backend servers. So if you have five friends and those five friends happen to be on different databases or different Memcache machines, you might end up accessing all of those machines and end up linking them in the process. So if you're not careful, you can actually cascade error from one machine to another machine. An example of this thing is that let's suppose one of the databases is slow for whatever reason. It's overloaded maybe because a particular user on the page has suddenly gotten very popular. Now, if you are trying to access many different databases, you might have open connections to every one of those databases. The fact that one of these connections is taking forever might mean that you're holding on to other connections for a lot longer, and then you might actually cause problems on those other machines that were fine until that point. So all this means is that we have to be a lot more mindful of propagating errors through the system and trying to build firewalls in various places. So the first lesson, an obvious lesson, is to try and avoid single points of failure in the system. So everyone who's worked on a large site knows that you build redundancy at every level of your hardware. So this means you have your replicated storage in many different copies. So like in our case, we have MySQL and we have master slave replication to have multiple copies of all data. Redundant load balancing, redundant network links between clusters, clusters that can fail independently. So if for whether fire or anything, you lose a cluster, you should be able to still serve traffic from other clusters. And then you always have spare capacity in all of these places so that when you have machine failures, which are pretty routine in a large site, you can handle them. So this is the obvious part that everyone knows. So the thing that often gets forgotten is that software is also can be a single point of failure. And actually, software tends to be much more challenging, mostly because software is much more subject to the butterfly effect, so that a small problem in one part of the site can take down the entire site. And this was like demonstrated in the case study that Bobby was talking about earlier, where the kind of change that was made was pretty routine, and no one would have predicted that that was potentially an impact on the site. Another way of putting this is that any number of other changes that go out could, if you did the analysis, you could conclude that they're just as risky. So it's not a complete oversight in that sense. So you need to be mindful of like the software failures propagating through your system and find ways of holding them back. So the standard example of a software failure could be that someone issues a bad query to delete data. Now, your replication system in MySQL or any other system you happen to use is designed to then execute the query in every single place. The fact that you have three copies doesn't help you because that query will get executed on all three copies and delete the data. So, so you need to watch out for the software points of failure. A set of related points, I'll start with don't make small problems big. Again, all of these points were illustrated in the example that Bobby described. So the somewhat related point here is that you do not want to push problems upstream because that's a way of taking a small problem and turning that into a big problem. So here's an example. Any system that you have will have machines failing periodically. So we routinely have memcache boxes crash, and then we quickly replace that with another memcache box. So given that this is such a routine thing, it makes sense that when a memcache box dies, you can use the data available elsewhere to continue to serve the page instead of just failing it. So we have many clusters. Even within a cluster, we have the memcache and the database, and database has the same data. So the obvious point is why not use the data from the database and serve the client when a memcache is down for a short period of time while it's being replaced. Now, this is actually a very good idea when it's a memcache or two memcache boxes down. What makes this challenging is that if you have an unusual event where many memcache boxes are down, it can actually be a bad idea. So memcache hit rates tend to be in high 90%, which means that a memcache box going down will generate 20x, 30x the amount of traffic to the database tier that was coming from that memcache box. The reason any of this actually even works, even for one memcache box, is that the memcache data is sharded differently from the database data, which means that when a memcache box goes down and you fall back to the database, that those requests get distributed across the entire database tier. And there's only a small increase in the amount of query on each single database. But when you have enough of these memcache boxes down, the load increase on the database tier can be substantial, in which case the right thing to do might very well be to not go to the database at all because you might be propagating a failure. So whenever you have a solution to recover from failure, there's always a risk that that's going to also amplify failures, and so you have to design it carefully to hit the right balance. The next point here is be a little wary of smart failover. So smart failure can often be dangerous. The standard scenario is we know that machines routinely crash, and we keep spare machines around, so why not go the last step of having something that's monitoring things, and the minute it detects something has crashed, rebuild it somehow to replace it completely automatically. The hard part of trying to automate the whole thing is that detecting the nature of the failure can be pretty hard in a complex distributed system. And so the rebuilding the machine on a failure is the right thing to do, that might be the right thing to do 99% of the time, but there might be a time where there's a different kind of failure that looks like the same thing to the whatever the monitoring thing happens to be. So it could be the network is down this time around or some other thing that makes it look like the machine is unavailable, and then you start building another machine, and that might actually worsen the entire problem. So at Facebook, our approach generally has been to try and automate as much as possible, but stop at the last step. And so any number of manual steps that you need to do to sort of fail over the machine, you build scripts, tools to automate it, but leave the decision of whether or not to do the failover to a human, because they can make the right call. The next point here is that shared load when you're in trouble. Here's the graph. It's sort of a made-up graph, but on the x-axis you have number of requests that a box is getting. This graph actually mirrors what we have actually measured on our web tiers. So on the x-axis you have the number of requests that a particular box is getting, and on the y-axis you have the response time. So as you increase the number of requests that a box is serving, the response time for each request stays fairly flat till you hit a particular point at which point the machine effectively starts thrashing, and then your response time spikes dramatically. So for these boxes, you never want to be operating in the red portion on the right-hand side, because for every single request, you're doing more damage than good at that point. And this is a behavior on a single box, but tiers of boxes and entire clusters also tend to have this behavior where if you push them beyond the point where they're comfortable handling their load, it can all fall apart at that point. So when a mistake or a bug or anything in the system, a hardware failure, causes you to have system-wide failures, the best thing to do is start shedding load immediately, because what that does is that it limits the damage while buying you time to work on the fix. Otherwise, you could spend substantial amount of time trying to maximize the amount of traffic you can continue to serve well. What you can do instead is just shed more than you think you need to, stabilize the system, and then work on the fix as quickly as possible and focus on bringing the site back up. And finally, reduce restart time. So when a site goes down, you need to have processes in place so you can bring it back up quickly. A general rule of the thumb for us is that if you lose half the machines, you should consider yourself lucky if you are you're able to serve half the traffic. Because there are lots of things in the system that means that makes it a challenge even to do that much. The next point is measure everything that you can on the site. So data is the key to preventing future failures as well as diagnosing past failures. So for this, you need to measure as much as you can. There's never such a thing as too much data. You want to measure activity counts, number of page requests, amount of queries on the various tiers, the number of requests in various tiers, all kinds of activities, performance statistics, CPU load, memory usage, latency, throughput, all of those kinds of things, and then failure rates. So you gather all this data, and you gather it from everywhere. So at Facebook, we gather performance data from the user perspective. So in browser, we have code that samples access times and records access times so that we know what the user experience is like, and we get heads up when something is spiking for any reason. You want monitoring every one of your components, network components, and servers. And then, of course, you want to measure on each individual machine, but also end-to-end. So when you measure things in the browser, we are often measuring things end-to-end. The first thing that you find every single time you start gathering new pieces of data is that you're going to discover problems you didn't know you had. So you decide that based on some past experience that, hey, next time this happens, it'll be good to have this data, and you add that data into your system. And what you find is that you thought you were, you know, gathering this data for the future, but you've actually discovered important problems that you would have fixed had you known they were occurring. So once you have data, then the second problem is now you have too much data to monitor. So on the right is a graph where on the x-axis it's the time of the day, and on the y-axis it's, let's say, the number of requests that a backend service sees. Now, the traffic on the site has a wavy pattern. We have peak traffic somewhere midday. We have a trough somewhere in the evening, and then Europe wakes up, and then there, we have another peak, and so on. So because the traffic on the site has that pattern, the backend services will typically also have a pattern like that. Now, it's not going to be a very smooth curve. There will be some weird hiccups because maybe the time when people in the US stop logging on and the time when Europeans start logging on, there's a difference, and then you see weird little bumps in the graph that reflect that you see every single day. And then on the right-hand side, there's another bump, which where you might have set up cron jobs to do, say, backups and so on when you have troughs in your system. Now, when you have a handful of machines or a handful of systems in your in your cluster, then you might know these patterns and you might know when an anomaly happens. But as you put more and more kinds of services in the backend, it gets harder and harder to keep track of what is normal and what's not normal. So the first cut, a while back, the way we detected something was anomalous was we had a high water mark and a low water mark. And that's useful to some extent. The problem is that because the axis pattern has a wave to it, you have to put your high water mark way above the high the peak and the low water mark below the trough. And then you might miss lots of bumps in your graph, which are pretty substantial, but well within that range. Another mistake that people sometimes make, we've made it several times, is that you often look for badness. But you should also look for surprise goodness, because sometimes that means that something actually bad is happening that you don't know about. So for instance, if your performance of your site improves substantially and you haven't actually done anything to improve performance, then chances are something is failing that's improving your average somehow. And so you want to look out for surprises either way. More recently, just because of the amount of data we are gathering these days and the difficulty of trying to monitor all of it, we've been deploying more machine learning-based tools to detect anomalies in these graphs so that we can then detect them early. The next point here is that you should be looking for the tremors that come before the big quake. So here's actual data from one of the incidents in one of the backend services. Often if you're looking at just the median average numbers, you might not see anything wrong till you have this tier follower. However, if you are looking at 95th percentile or 99th percentile, you might actually see something bad happening. So in this particular case, the big bump down in the middle of the graph is when the system crashed. But if you look to the left of that big crash, there are two circles. The bottom pair of lines correspond to the 95th percentile. The top pair of lines correspond to the 99th percentile. And you will see that at the 95th percentile, you actually had a small bump before the crash that reflected some badness. And at the 99th percentile, you had a big spike. And so if you're watching 99th percentile, you're much more likely to have spotted the problem. Because of this, here's an example dashboard. Because of our experience, this is the sort of data we have on the dashboard. So on the right-hand side, you have the usual things that you'd expect, the amount of CPU load, the query rate on these boxes, the amount of memory used, and so on. But what's most interesting is in the middle of the graph, we have these histograms which show where the median, where the 95th percentile, 99th percentile all happen. And when you see the 99th percentile start shifting on one of these machines, it might be a bigger problem down the road that you can start working on. The next lesson is to always do a postmortem. Recently, I was reading a book about, I'm blanking on the name right now, about surgeons and doctors who perform surgery. So lots of hospitals have this thing called the Morbidity and the Mortality Conference every week, which is basically where you review all the surgeries that went badly that week and try and figure out what you can learn from it. And the point there was the only reason that even works is that that's not a place to point fingers at people or blame people, but a place to learn so that you are constantly improving. Now, that's a place where people actually die when they're mistakes, and so that's a pretty nice property to have on when you're conducting your postmortems, which is things will go wrong. That's the choice we've made in choosing to move fast all the time. So we have, like at Facebook, a weekly review where we look at things that go wrong and figure out what we learn from it. And the key point here is that the focus is on learning, looking forward, and not in assigning blame to different people. The interesting thing here is that when you take away the blaming aspect of an issue, it turns into a very interesting exercise of trying to, like everyone is much more engaged, trying to figure out, almost like it's a murder mystery, what went wrong, what were the symptoms, what can we take away, what are the follow-up actions. And sometimes what you actually learn from these things is not just, hey, the system could have been built this way, but much more, like maybe we didn't figure out who was responsible for like jumping on the problem and fixing it. So as the organization grows, sometimes it's not immediately clear if there was a transition responsibility or not, and the lesson could very well be that person A is now responsible for the system, and when something goes wrong, they will be expected to fix it. Finally, a few words about our culture. Most of this has already been covered. I have just talked about always doing a postmortem. Another one that Bobby talked about is releasing code often allows us to continue to move fast. Otherwise, you have to worry about when you can release the product and a complicated scheduling problem. And finally, another lesson that's often forgotten is that control and responsibility go together. So if you're going to hold someone responsible for keeping a system up and running, then you have to give them the control that they need to do things. So if you allow everyone to dictate what happens to that system but hold that person responsible, that's never going to work. And so that's something you need to always handle. So I think that's the last slide. So at this point, we can take questions.
Hi, Matthew Sachs. Can you hear me? Try the other one.
I don't think that's on.
Hello. Getting.
All right, we'll just pass this around. I'd like to introduce Pedro and Adam, who are also work on our operations teams at Facebook. So, it's a question mic working now?
Okay, there we go. Matthew Sachs, Glasscode. I was wondering how you apply machine learning to your monitoring infrastructure. Like, what metrics do you crunch in your machine learning system?
I don't know too many details here, but the what happens is that we have an underlying system that does the modeling, but we still need to figure out ourselves what best correlates with the various lines. So for instance, for some things, yesterday's data and last week's data is a very good predictor of what is supposed to happen today, but sometimes there are correlations between not just time, but also a different piece of data. And so for now, we've been mostly trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work, and we deploy it, and then we see how many false positives, how many false negatives we are getting, and then decide whether that's a good thing or not. But over time, we should get better at that.
Can you talk about the specific implementation? Do you use Hadoop to do that, or?
No. So Hadoop is mostly used for offline processing. This is much more online processing because we need prediction every few minutes of what it's supposed to look like in 2 minutes from now and what it looks like in 2 minutes from now. So you can compare to see when those lines start diverging. So Hadoop is not what we use. It's just some online processing.
I see. So it's more real time.
Yeah, it's custom code. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. Hugh Brown from the University of British Columbia. You mentioned how people avoid thinking or don't often think of software as a single point of failure, and yet, you know, when you have problems, often it comes down to the software. Do you think it would be at all any less than completely insane to have something like, you know, two sets of software running to generate a page, or is that just so full of problems that it would not be a starter?
To some degree, we kind of do that. Usually, at any point, we're in some stage of rolling out new software on things.
Okay.
So we've never done like actually like run this system and somebody else wrote this system that's completely separate and then compare the results. I guess we do that when we launch new things. If you cared enough about something, I don't think that would be a completely crazy thing to do, because we see that the vast majority of our problems are because the software failed on every machine at once rather than this particular machine failed.
Thank you.
So just to follow up on what you said, we already do this in a couple of places where we first roll out changes to a small number of boxes, see if it's seeing a higher error rate before we go broader. For new compiler releases, we'll be running the new version for a while, much longer in parallel with the old version on a smaller set of boxes.
Hi, David Williamson, Microsoft Tele. A couple questions for you. You talked a little bit about redundancy, and obviously with high availability services, redundancy is a big part of the story. That only works really well when something is dead. Do you have anything that does any automatic detection and routing around components that are not dead but not healthy? Network links,
yeah.
Servers, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we'll do that's a very simple thing client-side that works really well is with, actually we'll find that the default behavior that a lot of clients use is actually exactly the opposite of what you want. So a server starts getting into a bad state, and what ends up happening is as it gets slower and slower, clients start retrying. And usually the reason it was slow is it had too much load. And now all of a sudden you've just doubled the load on it because everybody's retrying. So one thing we do in pretty much any client software is we actually use the opposite of a retry, which is if you try to talk to this thing and you don't get an answer back when you expect, just don't even try for a little while, you know, a second or a half a second or whatever.
So I can add a little bit there. So generally when building these big systems and you have a single client decision, you need to make the single client decision behave in a coordinated way, right? So when all the clients decide the same thing, they back off, like exponential back off with fuzzing over a range, so they all don't arrive at the exact same time when they synchronize. Is really like that, when you consider this problem, you're like, oh, that's totally obvious. But when you're writing a software, you don't usually think about it that way, right? You're like, oh, I'll just have it retry, right? Retry is better than serving an error. Depending on the system, we build stuff that we'll make a single client decision and try to fail in a graceful way and then eventually give up in a way that doesn't cascade and destroy things. But some classes of failure, you need coordination. And coordination is actually hard, because when the coordination goes away, then you can't make a decision, right? So there's no one answer, right? It's a challenge. But generally, we try to err on the side of single client decisions with graceful back off, right? Because coordination at large scales is hard.
And then also on the network side or on the clusters and load balancer side, we do have a lot of manual effort. We have some humans who are watching some certain failures, and we do route around it, but it is a human who's making that decision. There are large failure domains that we have, and when we do see things that are either full or they're having problems or they're slowing down, we do sort of route around them so that we don't hurt our users too much at that stage.
And just real quick, a second question. You mentioned you do rollouts to 1% of your user base for kind of initial testing with new releases. That's still 5 million people.
Yeah. Well, actually, 1% tells the story better. Usually, it's more like 0.1% or 0.01% to start.
I was wondering if you had engaged a statistician to figure out how much you need to do in order to actually have a valid enough sample for whatever testing you're doing.
Yeah, we have a few people who basically worry about running good experiments when we're trying to experiment on something. Less than 1% is plenty of signal.
Cool, thanks.
Razvan Musaloy from Google. You guys show a status page at some point. Is that real time or is significantly delayed? The one with the histograms.
Oh, yeah, that's real time. It's what we do for that is actually, we hook it in at the Thrift level. So any one of our services that uses Thrift, there's a common interface they expose, which is essentially get me statistics, essentially counters of anything that could possibly make sense for this application. And then those will be collected, I think it's maybe once a minute, every 2 minutes, something like that. Those get collected and sent into the essentially the data store for that system. And then you can pop up displays of this that are only a minute or two old. Because, if it's more than a minute or two, then it's almost useless for debugging a production problem. Because, so if you change something and you want to know if it worked, you have to wait the latency of your measurement system. So, we try to keep that very short.
And one more thing. So the small histograms, they look a little more like Sparkline. Very nice work. Do you guys have more things like that? Or do you rely on data visualization to catch some problems? Or?
Can you repeat the question? I couldn't.
So the question is, do you guys rely on data visualizers to catch some of the problems or make them more obvious than they probably? I mean, the histogram to me looks like pretty good way of doing.
Yeah, that. Yeah, it does look like a Sparkline, and that's been very handy. The other thing that's really handy are heat maps, where you just have a little, maybe basically a pixel of color for each server, and you see a lot of really interesting things pop out of that that if you're just digging through tables of data wouldn't show.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Chris Morton, Qualcomm. Could you talk more about that weekly morbidity conference? I'm curious. Who's invited? Is there a formal process around that? Or?
Sure. So it's actually a cross-functional team of engineering and operations people, everywhere from directors, VPs, managers, and individual contributors across the company, who sit down in a room for about an hour to hour and a half, mm-hmm. and talk about some of the major events that happened on the site. Like Sajeev said, it's really a situation where we all sit down and talk about the problem, what happened, what we could have done better. Is it a technology issue? Is it an organizational issue? Was it a human error, which does happen more often than we'd like, but we are humans that are actually making the computers do what we want them to do, so human error does happen.
Was that driven by upper management, or was it an idea that kind of floated up? Or?
I think it was being done informally for a long time, and at some point, as the company was starting to grow, it was decided that we needed to do it more formally. So I think from the very beginning, the move fast culture meant that people never got blamed for mistakes, or that was never part of the culture. But I think the meeting was much more in the last year or so.
Okay. Thank you.
It did start with me trying to chase everybody down and actually trying to find out what was going on, and then it became a much more formal effort.
Okay. Yeah, and that is a pretty key part of it. That, you know, part of the thought about being able to move fast and be okay with having mistakes is that you got to learn from them. And if you don't learn from mistakes, then the whole system doesn't really work. Any more questions? All right, well, thanks a lot.